Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
My guest today is Jane Trey Scott, who has written Cleopatra's Daughter, Egyptian Princess, Roman Prisoner, and African Queen. And today we are going to talk about Cleopatra. And I'm going to add as well that there might be minor disturbances today because I'm not in my home office. I'm in a more public place. I'm in it's a bit quiet here where I'm charging up, but there might be minor disturbances. So I'm so sorry if there are. But of course, I always begin asking our guests, how did it come about studying the Ptolemies and, of course, Cleopatra, whom we are going to talk about today?
Right. So I'm a Roman historian. I've been studying Roman history since I went to university. And when I did my PhD, I looked at health in Greco-Roman Egypt. So I suppose being interested in Greco-Roman Egypt got me interested in Cleopatra because you can't really do one without doing the other. And because I've ended up teaching a course on Cleopatra at the University of Glasgow, I've found myself, I suppose, thinking more and more about her over the last few years, and that's led me to research her and write about her and talk about her to anyone who's interested in listening. So that is it in a nutshell.
So let's begin with a little bit of background, because we have to understand the Ptolemies as well, and not to be confused with the scientist Ptolemy, who has no relations to the current these Ptolemies. So that, of course, they begin with the rise by the fall of Alexander's empire after his death, and that would pave the way for the dynasty until the fall of Cleopatra. So let's begin with a little background history on the Ptolemies.
So the founder of the dynasty is called Ptolemy Soter, and he is one of Alexander the Great's companions and one of his generals. And when Alexander dies and his empire is divided up between all of his former companions and generals, Ptolemy chooses Egypt. It's a very good choice. It is a very, very wealthy kingdom. It's very rich in natural resources, both things like grain and other crops because of the annual inundation of the Nile, but also things like metals and minerals in the quarries in the desert. And it also has the Red Sea trade with India and China. And it's also very easily protectable as well. And because the companions, the new kings, were all very very fractious and declared war on each other quite a bit. You know, there was a lot of upheaval in the wake of Alexander's death and the establishment of these new kingdoms, and they were all basically trying to get one over on each other and amass more and more territory at each other's expense. Ptolemy wanted to have a sort of defendable kingdom, and so Egypt is great for that, really. And so this is at the very end of the 4th century BCE when he's establishing his kingdom. And then we go down through the generations all the way to Ptolemy the 12th in the early to mid 1st century BCE. And Cleopatra is one of his children, one of his daughters, and she is born in around 69 BCE. She's his second daughter. He has an older daughter, Berenike, then Cleopatra, then a younger daughter, Arsinoe, and then two sons who would go on to be Ptolemy the 13th and Ptolemy the 14th.
And I should also mention that she isn't the only Cleopatra in the dynasty. So if you read about the Ptolemies, there's quite a few Cleopatras down there. So she isn't the first Cleopatra either.
Yes, exactly. Cleopatra is a very sort of popular Greek name, Macedonian name, and it's part of dynasty from quite early on. And so the Cleopatra that we're talking about today is actually the 7th Cleopatra. So when she's written about in ancient history textbooks, we refer to her as Cleopatra the Seventh.
And of course, we discussed this in our episode with Adrian Jonesworth a while ago on Julius Caesar, when because they were quite kind of like the Habsburgs in a way. They were quite incestuous in the Ptolemy dynasties, and this justice said that is, she might have been the result of a concubine, because she doesn't seem to be having, you know, that the Habsburg jaw, any signs of, you know, the incest traits that you find that can become quite common after a few generations. She doesn't seem to have any traces of that, so we discussed that she could be the result of a concubine, and that's how she was. Oh, she doesn't have this in is, you know, Habsburg traits, to put it that way.
Well, the Ptolemies do practice incestuous marriage, brother sister marriage, but there is this question mark over whether these were full consummated marriages or just sort of diplomatic marriages. So the first Ptolemies to do this, Ptolemy the Second and his sister Arsinoe, they don't have any children. Ptolemy the Second's heir, Ptolemy the Third, is his child from an earlier marriage. So it's possible that some of the brother-sister marriages that take place through the family line are consummated and children do arise from those. But it's also possible that they didn't. So we don't actually know precisely how incestuous and inbred the Ptolemaic dynasty was. I mean, certainly the Ptolemies intermarry with members of other neighboring dynasties, the Seleucids, the Attalids, etc., as well. So we are seeing sort of new members of the family brought in. And so when it comes down to Cleopatra, her father, Ptolemy the 12th, is actually he's illegitimate. He is not the son of his father and his father's wife. He is the son of his father and a mistress. So we don't know who his mother was. And likewise, we don't know who Cleopatra's mother was. So again, she could have been the child of a mistress, because Strabo, an ancient geographer who writes about Egypt, he writes that only Berenike, Ptolemy the 12th's eldest daughter, was legitimate. So from his marriage, and the younger four children were illegitimate, so from someone else. And so, yes, I don't think we need to worry about Cleopatra being inbred or anything like that.
Another thing I wanted to discuss before we go into her life as well is that we don't really know what she looked like. We do have the famous bun behind her head on the statue, but that's about it. We don't really know. She has been described as beautiful, but some historians doubt that it was more her intelligence that made her beautiful. Not she wasn't necessarily beautiful in the sense that we think of beautiful, but you know, we don't really know what she looked like either.
Absolutely. It's very late writers like Cassius Dio, so hundreds of years after Cleopatra's death, that start calling her beautiful and explaining that her appeal to Caesar and Antony and potentially Octavian as well was down to how beautiful and sexy she was. Whereas Plutarch, who he was writing after Cleopatra's death, but he was using information from people who had known her at the time. His grandfather had contacts in the royal court, so they had some family stories. So Plutarch tells us that it's not that she's beautiful, it's not that she's not beautiful, it's just that her appeal and her charm is to do with her personality and her charisma. And so we know that she was very intelligent, and we know that she was very well educated. And we know, based on what Plutarch tells us, that she had a beautiful speaking voice and was very good at sort of conversation and I guess what we today would call people skills. She was very good at sort of manipulating people, at presenting herself to people in a way that would appeal to them. So she's different with Caesar than she is with Antony, and then she's different again with Octavian. So yes, I think this is a case of a woman who is appealing because of her personality and the fact that she's extremely wealthy and has a lot of money that Romans want to make use of.
So let's talk about the upbringing in the Ptolemy. What was it like to be a Ptolemy child? And you talked about the education, and of course, it must seem quite a lot of education, considering she spoke of well over four languages, I believe, seven, if I remember correctly. And so let's talk about the education under the Ptolemies and in for Cleopatra and her upbringing.
So we don't know anything for sure about her upbringing or the upbringing of any of her siblings, really, because ancient authors are not interested in children. They do not care, really, to record childhood, even of famous people, unless something strange happens that throws a light on who they later become, something that can be attributed to the gods. So Cleopatra, well, she would have been born in Egypt, probably in Alexandria. She would have spent her childhood in Alexandria at the royal court. She would have been very well educated because that's something that Hellenistic royal families, they do care very much about education. It's something that they all compete with each other about. And Hellenistic monarchs are very educated and cultured. They write their own scholarship. They speak a lot of languages. They do all sorts of medical experimentation and things like that. So Cleopatra had the benefit of growing up next to the Great Library and the Museion, and there are a whole lot of very important intellectuals who work out of those places. And so she was probably educated using the resources of the library and the resources of this circle of intellectuals, because we do hear about her being interested in medicine and pharmacy and pharmacology and toxicology and cosmetics and even alchemy potentially. So she is clearly very she has a very inquiring mind, and she puts that to good use. And obviously she would have been educated in things like diplomacy as well, and what was required to rule a kingdom, because the Ptolemies don't just reign, they rule. They are the commanders of the armed forces. They are the ultimate sort of person to whom you can petition on the administrative side about things to do with the law and with money and everything else.
So let's talk about her marriage to her brother, which of course then we all know how that ends up, but let's talk about what point in how old were they when they got married, Ptolemy and Cleopatra?
Well, the Ptolemies need to have a king and a queen. It's very, very unusual for a king or a queen to reign by themselves. And it doesn't tend to last very long or go very well when they try. So it's standard to have a king and a queen. And because Cleopatra's father dies in around 51 BCE, he names her as his oldest surviving daughter, and Ptolemy XIII as his oldest surviving son, as king and queen joint rulers. Now, Cleopatra at this time is about 18, so she's basically an adult woman, and Ptolemy XIII is about 10, so he's a child. He is really not particularly significant as far as his ability to rule is concerned. He has a bunch of advisors, Pothinus, Achilles, who do it for him. And so when we hear about the power struggles between Cleopatra and Ptolemy XIII, in the first couple of years, so from 51 BCE, Cleopatra initially tries to marginalize Ptolemy XIII and rule mainly by herself. And then from about 49, Ptolemy XIII manages to depose Cleopatra and take power. What we're really hearing about are struggles between their political factions. I mean, Cleopatra as an adult is obviously wielding influence herself, but Ptolemy XIII, it's because he's got adult male advisors who are doing it for him. So their marriage is entirely a diplomatic marriage of convenience. It's in name only. She's 18, he's 10. It's that they're being he's being controlled by his advisors. It's not what we would recognize as any kind of partnership.
Was What did you just have regency, or was it didn't matter if you were a woman or a man who reigned on the throne? She had full power as queen when she reigned. She wasn't just a regent until Ptolemy was of age.
No, I mean the well, it depends on who you ask. From the Roman perspective, they were both children and needed to have Roman oversight. So one of the reasons that the Romans get involved in Egypt is because there's this idea that Ptolemy the 12th, their father, has basically left them to Rome. He's made Rome essentially their regent. He's made his friend Pompey their guardian. And this is from the Roman perspective. And they, of course, do not agree with this. They Cleopatra is perfectly capable of ruling independently, and Ptolemy the 13th's advisors do not want any sort of Roman interference. So there is this question of who exactly should be the person in charge of this situation, and they all have different ideas about it. And yes, I mean, as we see later in her life, Cleopatra rules alongside her son Ptolemy the 15th, Caesar, the son of Caesar, who's known as Caesarion, Little Caesar. And so, although technically he is the king and the pharaoh ruling alongside her, in reality he is a baby and then a child. And it's not until he's about 16 that he starts actually doing things as king and pharaoh. So she not you know is ruling in his name for many years.
So, of course, if she doesn't rule for long, as you mentioned, she got expelled in 49 BC by her brother. So let's talk about, because I personally, what does she do before she does meet Caesar, of course, eventually, but what does she do in the meantime before she meets Caesar? Does she try to build up forces against Ptolemy, or how does she plan to take over Fort Q from the start?
I think there's, again, it's not really a very well-attested period of history because we hear about it through Roman sources, and the Romans are really only interested as far as it pertains to Rome. So we hear about the power struggle between Cleopatra and Ptolemy the 13th because Caesar is involved when he goes to Alexandria later and gets involved in the civil war between them and has to basically choose a side and try and find a solution. So we don't get the sort of precise blow-by-blow account of what happened. So Cleopatra is deposed at some point in 49. She goes to Upper Egypt to potentially try and gather some support from the people there, whereas Ptolemy the 13th is obviously in Alexandria with the court. That doesn't work. At some point, she goes to Syria, neighboring region. She may take her younger sister Arsinoe with her then, although Arsinoe later is back in Egypt on the side of Ptolemy the 13th and Ptolemy the 14th. So it's all quite messy, and we're not really sure who was where and when they were there. What we do know is that Ptolemy the 13th's advisors make really a catastrophic mistake, and that's that they kill Pompey
Yeah, I want to bring that up. Yeah,
when
because as you know, there's a Caesar at this point has crossed the Rubicon, of course, and there is a civil war. As you know, the Romans love their civil wars, and Pompey eventually end up losing and flees to Egypt, and there Ptolemy capture him, and as you said, he behead him, and he shows Caesar his head on a plate, as they say, the story goes. So. What does the how the let's talk about Caesar's arrival in Egypt and how he's there, how he's there, cry almost weep when he sees Pompey's head on a plate and what goes on there. So let's talk about Caesar's stay in Egypt, which is of course one of the most more famous aspects of Cleopatra's life.
Yeah, so Pompey has come to Egypt because Caesar has really rather decisively defeated him in battle in the civil war and in this particular stage of the civil war. So Pompey comes to Egypt hoping that he can get help basically from Cleopatra and Ptolemy the 13th to rebuild his forces and his war chest and everything else. he's mistaken. Ptolemy the 13th, Cleopatra's not there. You know, she's gone. Ptolemy the 13th's advisors do not want to get involved in a Roman civil war. They do not want Roman interference in their kingdom, taking control of their charge, Ptolemy the 13th. So they ambush Pompey, they murder him, they cut off his head. And when Caesar arrives in Egypt chasing Pompey, just, you know, a little while later, and is confronted with Pompey's head on a plate in a box, however you want to sort of imagine it, he is probably, on the one hand, a little bit relieved because the death of Pompey means, you know, the death of his opponent. But he is also, Pompey was his friend and his ally. At one point, Pompey was his son-in-law and the father of his grandchild before his daughter and his grandchild died. So he and Pompey have been close for many years. And it's also massively disrespectful to Rome for such a thing to happen. And so he's grief-stricken and he's furious. And he basically wants to sort the situation out to Rome's satisfaction, really, because Ptolemy the 12th owed a lot of money to various Romans, including Caesar. He wants that money back. He needs that money for his wars and his initiatives at home. And Egypt needs to be stable because they need the grain and all the other natural resources that the...
But they were in a breadbasket at the time to Rome.
Yeah, exactly. Because of the Nile and the inundation and the sort of agricultural fertility of Egypt, it was a huge source of Egyptian grain. And so Caesar really needs to get Egypt under control so that he can get back to doing everything else that he needs to do. So he's not endeared to Ptolemy the 13th because of the head on a plate. Cleopatra sees her opportunity. She arranges a meeting with Caesar, and we have the story of her being wrapped in a carpet or in a bag or something like that and being sort of dumped out at his feet. However she got into the palace, she did so secretly. She has this meeting with Caesar. She clearly proves to him that she is capable of ruling Egypt. And when the next morning...
And they did that even more than talk, just talking, as we know.
Well, maybe, I don't know, at that stage, maybe later. But certainly the next morning after their meeting, when Caesar and Cleopatra appear together, Ptolemy the 13th has a massive tantrum and is not happy about it. But to all intents and purposes, Caesar says, I am going to enforce the terms of your father's will. You are ruling together. That's that. And well, it's not that. There is then a sort of civil war in Alexandria over the next few months while Ptolemy the 13th's faction fight Cleopatra and Caesar's faction. But ultimately, what happens is Ptolemy the 13th dies in battle, or at least he falls off his ship in the middle of a battle and drowns in full armor in the Nile, which means that the crown passes to Ptolemy the 14th, the youngest brother, and Cleopatra and Ptolemy the 14th are set up as king and queen of Egypt. Cleopatra has Caesar's baby, or a baby that she claims is Caesar's. Caesar doesn't argue with her about this. And so Cleopatra is basically ruling independently because, once again, she is now 20 or thereabouts, a little bit older, and her brother, youngest brother, once again, is sort of 10 or so. And there's no competition, really. And so when Caesar finally leaves Egypt, he's stabilized the country. He's gone on a massive Nile cruise with Cleopatra and a load of navy and armed forces showing the population of Egypt. This is your queen. She's backed by Rome. Behave yourselves. He leaves and Cleopatra is then left in charge of Egypt.
And of course, she's left alone because she does get a pregnancy after Caesar leaves Egypt to the infamous Caesarion.
Yeah, so she has a son, she has an heir, so she's pretty satisfied. She's got her position has been approved by Rome. It's confirmed by Rome. She's got troops there to back her up. She's got a son that she can use as her successor. And once she has her son Caesarion, her brother mysteriously dies because he is now irrelevant and surplus to requirements. So Ptolemy the 14th dies, and he is replaced as her co-ruler by the baby Caesarion. So to all intents and purposes, Cleopatra is ruling Egypt alone as Queen Regnant.
So, and let's talk about the next big event, which is, of course, the death of Caesar. And she goes to Rome after his death to, you know, and believe it. Does she believe that Caesarion should be the rightful heir, her son of Caesar? And, or does she just want, you know, that, you know, leverage, you know, what is her plan for Rome when she comes back after Caesar's death?
Well, so Cleopatra is in Rome in 44 when Caesar is assassinated, and she leaves pretty quickly because it's not a safe place for her to be, for Caesarion to be. There's a lot of civil unrest in Rome over the coming months. Now, I don't think Cleopatra had any plan for Rome whatsoever. All she really wanted from Rome was support. She has her kingdom. She has her realm. One of the things that she wants to do is improve the strength and stability of the Ptolemaic kingdom. It was once a massive empire. It had much more territory around the Mediterranean during the reigns of Ptolemy I, Ptolemy II, than it has during Cleopatra's reign. And what she wants to do is make Egypt strong and stable, so that she can pass it on to her children, to the next generation, continue the Ptolemaic dynasty. She wants to keep Egypt as an independent kingdom. She doesn't want it being taken by Rome and turned into a province the way that had happened to all the rest of Alexander's generals' kingdoms. So as far as she's concerned, what she wants from Rome is what she's currently got. She wants to continue that. So after Caesar's death, for a little while, she's really not sure who is the best Roman to ally herself with. And she finds that Brutus and Cassius, two of Caesar's assassins, are in the Near East and they want Egyptian support. And because she's a Roman client queen, she's obliged to give it to them. But she prevaricates and delays. And in the end, she doesn't end up giving them anything. So when Antony comes into the Near East, once he is sort of formally one of the triumvirate and is given control of the Near East and has to sort it all out, she's able to say to him, you know, I didn't help them. I remained loyal to Caesar. Let's work together. And she basically wants Antony to be like Caesar, to be her benefactor and to represent her interests in Rome. But I don't think she ever had any idea, any thought that Caesarion might rule Rome or do anything in Rome, because he's not Roman. He's Caesar's son, but legally he's not a Roman citizen. He's an Egyptian. He's a foreigner, so he can't do anything in Rome apart from be a client king of Egypt.
Now, you do have the famous story. I don't remember exactly when this happened, but you know they do get involved in the romance as well, Cleopatra and Antony. So, I mean, they have the famous, I don't remember what the topic was, but the general comes in and he sees them together and he says, and he tells him something. I don't remember exactly how the story goes, but Antony replies back, "Who cares of screen or princess?"
It's a little bit more than that. So he and Octavian obviously have an ongoing rivalry as to who is really Caesar's heir, and you know, Octavian can claim that he was legally Caesar's heir. He was adopted by Caesar, so he is now going by the name of Caesar himself. Whereas Antony, of course, was Caesar's, you know, number two, his ally. He's a better more experienced politician in general. And there is a period later on where Antony is married to Octavian's sister, Octavia, and so they exchange letters and basically, yes, Antony's saying to him, look, why do you care? You know, you have all sorts of bits on the side and I don't care about those. Why do you care about mine? And, you know, Octavian cares because it suits him to care, because it's something that he can hold over Antony, that Antony has this relationship with this this foreign woman, this powerful woman who is basically his boss. And he makes out that, you know, Antony is emasculated by Cleopatra and everything else. But I think we don't know really a lot about Caesar's relationship with Cleopatra, because I think it suited the later sources to try and sort of basically cover it up. Because, of course, Caesar was Octavian's adopted father. Octavian doesn't want Caesar being, you know, bad-mouthed because of his relationship with Cleopatra. So we don't know very much about it. Whereas Octavian wants to badmouth Antony and to use his relationship with Cleopatra against him. So we hear a lot more about their relationship and about how, you know, Antony is basically how he's running around after Cleopatra. He's doing what she says. He's massaging her feet in public. He's doing all these sort of humiliating, degrading things that Roman men should never do. And the interesting thing about it is that when we read these sources today, we can read them as, oh, they actually have a nice relationship. They have a genuinely sort of, it's romantic, it's passionate, it's a relationship of equals. They're working together to try and achieve the same goals. It does seem that they genuinely care for each other. It's not just simply a transactional sort of relationship. And so we today will read the sources in a different way to how ancient Romans thought about all of these things. You know, you didn't have a relationship of equals. The man was the superior partner, and for a man to give up any of his autonomy to a woman was just unthinkable. And so this is why Antony is presented in a very negative light for his relationship with Cleopatra, because he's happy to work with her and to do things that she wants done.
So, of course, as you know, that Octavian and Antony do work together to defeat Brutus and Pompey's son. So, in the end, they do win, but then they do have a falling out. And the next big thing, of course, is the Battle of Actium, where Cleopatra as well is present with her navy and her fleet. So, but they do lose, of course. But let's talk about the Battle of Actium and Cleopatra's fleet at the present.
Yeah, Actium is quite interesting because it's made out in Octavian's propaganda. Actium is made out to be this massive, important, emphatically decisive battle in which he defeated Antony and Cleopatra and became master of the Roman world. And in reality, it's really not like that at all. It's pretty minor, pretty disappointing. It's not really much to do with Octavian. It's his right-hand man, his Admiral Agrippa, is the one that sort of wins the battle. And it's really only won in one respect, because Cleopatra leaves. But what Antony and Cleopatra wanted to accomplish, their ships were blockaded in. So they wanted to break through the blockade and get out away from Actium, and they managed to do that. But because they left, it's painted as a defeat for Antony. But of course, it's another year before Octavian actually goes to Alexandria and invades Egypt. So there's a whole year after Actium where Cleopatra is still queen. Antony is still triumvir. There's a whole lot of diplomatic activity and embassies going between the different groups. And Antony still has a lot of Romans on his side, a lot of senators with him, a lot of consuls. He still has his legions, etc. So when Octavian, and when he's Augustus as well later, when he promotes Actium and he puts it up in stone reliefs and has arches and all sorts of displays and coins and all those sorts of things, and it's written about in poetry by Virgil, it's made out to be a big deal. And really, that's a sort of retrospective sort of rewriting of the history to make it a bigger deal. So it's the foundation of his authority, but it's not really a very strong foundation. It takes what happens the following year when he and his army finally get to Egypt and Antony's forces basically desert him at that point. That's when the decision is made, right, okay, Octavian is the winner here.
And of course, that's they do get, and she did get another kid by Antony as well. So let's talk about the birth of Alexander, Helos, and Cleopatra, etc.
Yeah, so this is one of the things about
Cleopatra, not Cetra.
So Cleopatra's relationship with Antony, it lasts for a decade, and they have three children. They have the fraternal twins, Alexander Helios and Cleopatra Selene. And then they have a younger son, Ptolemy Philadelphos. And the plan, they have plans for these three children. These three children are going to be kings and a queen themselves. They give them territories. They have an idea that in the Near East, that they will rule their own kingdoms under the sort of umbrella of Cleopatra. So there is an idea for their dynasty, basically, for Cleopatra's dynasty and then her own and Antony's dynasty. So these children are important. When they're born, they are seen as being the future. And obviously we know in hindsight that it doesn't work out, but certainly it was all very exciting at the time that there are these, you know, Cleopatra has four children. Octavian only has one, you know, it's this huge achievement that she's got all these children that she can put into service for her dynasty.
So of course the legitimization of Caesarion is of course important as well, because it wasn't birth. And the legitimization, legitimization of was kind of a big deal as well in ancient Rome. And he hasn't been legitimized until 34 BC, was he?
Well, his legitimacy is irrelevant. It's something that really wasn't an issue at the time. It didn't matter to the Egyptians. He was Cleopatra's son. He was the son of Caesar. She's able to present herself as Isis and Caesar as Osiris and Caesarion as Horus. And that works very neatly in the Egyptian belief system, because Osiris was dead and Isis and Horus had to sort of...
So it wasn't like the Roman world then, where legitimacy was important from birth on?
No, not at all. So in Egypt, Caesarion is the king. He is the pharaoh. It really doesn't matter. For the Romans, it also really doesn't actually matter, because Caesarion isn't Roman. He's not Caesar's heir. He has no legal rights. He can't sit in the Senate or anything else. And the only reason it's an issue is because Octavian likes to present himself as the son of Caesar. And of course, he's Caesar's great nephew, and so he is related to Caesar. But the reason he's able to present himself as the son of Caesar is because Caesar adopted him in his will. And so Octavian owes all of his own personal authority to this adoption. He's only got access to Caesar's money and Caesar's soldiers because of this adoption. And so he doesn't want any rivals. And so that includes Caesarion, but it also includes Antony and any other influential Roman. So, I mean, it's one of the reasons that he has Antony's oldest Roman son, Antyllus, murdered in Alexandria, because Antyllus would be Antony's heir, his political heir, his military heir. Antyllus could do for Antony what Octavian has done for Caesar and avenge him later. So he has him murdered. So Octavian doesn't want any rivals of any kind. And so it just so happens that Caesarion, by bearing the name Caesar, is a bit more of an obvious rival than some of the other people who are part of all of this as well.
Something that's fascinating to me is that Octavian kind of just disappeared from history. We don't really hear much about him. And he isn't really important as you think he would become, because he's exactly Caesar's son and Cleopatra's son. You think he would play a more important part in the aftermath to try to, you know, for example, avenged for the Egyptian throne and going back where his claim is right, but he does just kind of disappear out of history.
Well, he's murdered, so that's the thing. In hindsight, because all the sources know that he was murdered, they don't need to apply any sort of importance to him because they know how historians. So yes, at the time, he was potentially quite a dangerous prospect because Cleopatra sends him away from Egypt. The plan is for him to go over to India, and he's intercepted on his way there. So if he'd managed to leave Egypt and go off to India, we probably would have, over the next few years, that there would have been sort of worries about, oh, is he going to come back? Is he going to bring an army back to Egypt? Or is he simply going to, you know, be a rich, sort of leisurely nothingness in India and just sort of die young from sort of dissipation? So we'd certainly have heard about what he was doing after that. But yes, he's murdered. So his story comes to an end, and it suits everybody to pretend that there's nothing else to worry about. And the same is true of Antony and Cleopatra's other sons, Alexander Helios and Ptolemy Philadelphos. They die, we assume, because they disappear from history. We don't even get information. We don't know if they were murdered. We don't know if they just died of illness. They just disappear because they have ceased to be relevant to the story, because the story is now about Octavian becoming Augustus and being the Roman emperor. So these loose ends from the Republic are not something that later commentators bother to write about, because by that time, they really were insignificant, no matter how important they'd been at the time.
And of course, let's talk about the infamous death of Antony and Cleopatra, because it's kind of a Romeo. I feel like it's kind of a Romeo and Juliet death over their death as well.
Yeah, it's got a little bit of everything. It's very sad and very tragic. It's also got a bit of comedy, and it's also got a bit of mystery to it as well. So by the time we get to the summer of 30, Cleopatra has basically washed her hands of Antony. He has ceased to be useful to her. He's actually actively harmful at this point. You know, she's been writing to Octavian. She has been proposing to him things like, you know, she could abdicate in favor of the children. She could, you know, give him Antony. Octavian has made it clear that, yes, Antony's got to go. For there to be any sort of future for Cleopatra, for her children, for the dynasty, Antony's got to be taken out of the equation. So he is now a liability for her. And so she writes to him. She writes him a letter telling him that she has committed suicide. And so he's so distraught about this that he then tries to commit suicide himself. He doesn't make a success of it. He injures himself quite badly. Then he finds out that she's not actually dead. And so he drags himself sort of through the palace to Cleopatra's mausoleum, where she's barricaded herself inside with all of her treasure. And he manages to sort of climb up through the window into the mausoleum. She manages
to picture him dragging himself all over the palace in drain, yeah, blood, and just trying to get to Cleopatra. You can really imagine the scene there.
It is. I mean, it must have been sort of simultaneously hilarious and horrible to see this poor, bleeding, disemboweled man trying to kind of climb in through this window. And Cleopatra and her maids trying to kind of pull him in. Must have been like a sight to behold. So then in the mausoleum, he dies in her arms, and she is apparently grief-stricken by this. But before she can do anything else, the Romans manage to break in. And so she tries to stab herself in the chest. They stop her. They disarm her. She's then put under house arrest in the palace for the next couple of weeks. She tries to starve herself to death. Octavian threatens to kill her children to sort of make her eat. So she starts eating. She still thinks at that point that she can potentially salvage the situation. She thinks that they can come to an agreement. Antony's dead. He's out of the way. So she thinks she can either stay in power in Egypt, or she can abdicate in favor of her children. But she realizes that no, that's not what's going to happen. Octavian is going to seize Egypt, turn it into a Roman province, and he will take her back to Rome and he will put her on display in his triumph. And then either he will murder her, because that can sometimes happen. Caesar had Vercingetorix, one of the Gallic kings, murdered after his triumph. Or she lives in obscurity under house arrest in some villa in Rome, and she doesn't really want to do that either. So that's when she poisons herself in some way that the Romans don't really know.
So I want to know how much, I do believe Shakespeare used Plutarch for his plays about Caesar and Mark Antony, but how much of the death scene in his play is an invention, and how accurately did he get the death scene of Cleopatra and Antony?
Well, there were witnesses. They had plenty of witnesses, both on the street in Alexandria, outside the mausoleum. Inside the mausoleum, there were staff. And this is what we have to remember. When the sources don't necessarily tell us this, but wealthy people in antiquity were always, always attended by enslaved people. So they always had staff around them. And the staff were basically seen as part of the furniture and not worth specifically mentioning, but they were there. And so we know that Cleopatra Olympos wrote about her death. And this is one of the sources that Plutarch uses for his later writing. And we know also that Plutarch's grandfather had friends in Alexandria. So I think the scenes are likely to be fairly accurate, because we do have named sources and named documents of where all the information came from. So what's in Plutarch is largely accurate. Then Shakespeare uses translations of Plutarch to write his plays. So the plays are in some respects are quite faithful to certain scenes from the life of Plutarch. And so I think it's probably more likely to be accurate than a lot of other ancient, events.
Other Shakespeare plays.
like more accurate than Macbeth, for example. But as it turned out, I mean, people thought that Shakespeare's depiction of Richard III was all negative propaganda and all untrue. And then when they found Richard III, it turned out that actually he did have a spinal curvature and so on. So Shakespeare wasn't like making stuff up to sort of promote the Tudor dynasty. So yeah, maybe Shakespeare is actually quite accurate.
So something that's fascinating to me, and we spoke about this in the second episode about Egypt as well, where it's that the pyramids are equally old to Cleopatra as she is to us. That's kind of crazy to think about, that they are, where at already 2,000, over 2,000 years, and she is 2,000 years old to us now. So it's crazy to think about how old they actually are at this point in time. Even in antiquity, they were ancient to the Egypt, to the ancient to the Romans as well.
Well, this is something to bear in mind when we talk about Egypt. Egypt was so much older than Rome. Rome was a relatively new city-state during the latter part of the Republic. It's only very recently become a Mediterranean empire. And so it's one of the things that we see, actually, the comparison between the city of Alexandria, which is this amazing Hellenistic showcase of like beautiful brand new buildings, and Rome, which is this very sort of topsy-turvy, higgledy-piggledy, grotty sort of shambling city made of mud and stucco. And it's one of the things that Octavian does when he becomes Augustus, and he has all of the money from the conquering Egypt and taking all of the Egyptian assets. He rebuilds the city of Rome. You know, it's said he found Rome a city of brick and he left it a city of marble. And it's true, because having seen the cities in the east like Alexandria and returning to Rome and thinking, this really isn't the capital of a world empire. And it needs to be. And so he perhaps more than anyone else, really put his mark on Rome as a city to try to make it compete with places like Alexandria.
Do we know if they believe that the pyramids were built by alien as well, or is
I don't
that
think anyone sensible believes that the pyramids were built by
fair
aliens. And
enough, fair enough.
I know that the Romans did believe that there was a man in the moon. They did write about the face that you could see in the moon. And there is an ancient Roman science fiction novel called A True Story. And that imagines the kinds of strange races that live on the moon. But I don't know that they necessarily thought about aliens in the way that we do.
Thank you so much for coming. It was always a pleasure to talk with you. Before you go, of course, do you have any social media you want to need to put in the description, or where people can find your books, and a website you want people to go to, or if they have any questions, where they might find you?
I am at JL Draycott on Twitter. I have a personal website. You can find out all about my books and everything else on there. And I also have a University of Glasgow webpage, which is a little bit more academic if you want sort of academic information. So yes, if you Google me, you will find me.
Again, thank you so much for coming on. This has been One That Aged Well. We are available on YouTube, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, wherever you can find podcasts these days. I'm sorry if there were any background noise on this episode. I do apologize for that. I'm not at my home office, as I mentioned in the beginning, so I apologize again. But if you like this episode, consider writing a little review on Apple Podcasts. That would help us out a lot. Please like, share, and subscribe, and I'll see you next time.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.